This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
The early church was composed in large measure of a collection of families who followed Joseph Smith in the Restoration. From one of those families came two brothers whose impact on the church was enormous. Next on the Joseph Smith Papers, the Pratt Brothers, Parley and Orson.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Channel now presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
KJAZ Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
In a revelation, the Lord spoke of those who are the first laborers in this last kingdom. Well, among those first laborers were the two brothers, Parley and Orson Pratt. And while they were very different individuals, they were very much alike in their dedication and sacrifice to the kingdom.
David J. Whitaker.
Like many early Mormon families, the Pratts came from families that had come from England, families that were influenced by the Puritan movement of the 1600s and 1700s. Who saw problems in the Anglican Church of England, who sought to, in various ways, to reform it, to purify. That's how the word Puritan comes from. But in time found that staying in England was really not an option. And so with two of the Pratt, early Pratt descendants, came with Richard Hooker to the American colonies and began to establish relationships and farming and so forth. We usually think of Orson and Parley Pratt. But in fact, there are actually five brothers that came from the union of Jared and Charity Pratt. The first was Anson, born in 1801, I believe, the oldest son. He would, as was the case with these poor New England farmers, they often farmed out their children to work on other farms to raise money and to provide. And sometimes the families would lose touch with these sons. William was one of those that occurred to. He disappears. And it isn't until years later that Parley, in fact, finds him living about 30 miles from him in Ohio. And he writes about it in his autobiography, seeing or hearing about this Anson Pratt living close. And he says, could that be my missing brother? And he goes, and they have this great reunion. And in time, of course, he joins the church. The second son was William Pratt. He would join the church as well, would eventually, with David Patton, carry what we know today as Section 101 to the Missouri Saints after they'd been expelled from Missouri, and would be involved with that, and in fact would be the people that brought the news to the Missouri Saints that Zion's Camp would soon follow, and then was a part of that experience as well. Having proved his faithfulness in 1835, William would be called as a member of the First Council of 70 in Kirtland and would remain true in the church, performing a lot of missions. He was never a writer, but he was a powerful teacher and did a number of things in the church. Didn't die, I think, till the 1870s. But because of the really power of the next two sons, Parley first and then Orson, the other three sons are pretty well forgotten in Mormon history. The last born son was Nelson. He's the only one of the Pratt brothers that never joined the church. He was born was a hardworking Christian individual, but just as he corresponded, we have letters in the church archives that he wrote to Orson, keeping sort of up to date. He struggled for much of his life as a hard scrabble farmer.
The surviving record indicates that Jared and Charity Pratt raised their sons well. In his autobiography, Parley said this, "At the age of 7 years, my mother gave me lessons to read in the scriptures. I read of David and Goliath, of Saul and Samuel, of Samson and the Philistines. All these inspired me with hatred to the deeds of evildoers and love for good men and their deeds. After this, I read of Jesus and his apostles, and oh, how I loved them. How I longed to fall at the feet of Jesus, to worship him or to offer my life for his.
They grew up in a very Christian home. The Bible's read to them. The parents were concerned that they know the rudiments of reading and a little bit of math, I suppose. But basically, all the sons are self-educated. They get it when they can. And so you have Parley and Orson, whom we're going to talk about now in more detail, both talk about their early desire for learning. They're reading the Bible. They're concerned to be good Christians, but not having really much formal schooling other than maybe a winter school, which could be when the farming chores were down. They often had winter schools for a month or two, and they may have attended that, but it's difficult to know.
Parley wrote of leaving home when he was just 16 years old. He said this, "I left the school of my boyhood forever and commenced again a life of toil. I started a journey to the West in company with my brother William, in search of some spot of ground in the wilderness which we might prepare as our future home."
Parley, of course, early on was drawn toward Methodism and particularly the Campbellite movement. Knew Sidney Rigdon very early, but just couldn't get a handle on what church was true. He tells in his autobiography that he sort of finally withdrew. He'd invested in some farmland in Ohio with his brother William, and because they were unable to meet the bills for that, the owner took the property back. And he didn't know what to do with himself. And so he went into sort of a wilderness area in Ohio, not far from today's Cleveland, built a little cabin and spent the winter reading. He says that he read the accounts of Lewis and Clark's expedition in the West. You almost see him as sort of a Henry David Thoreau figure, going out in the wilderness, trying to get in touch with what really matters. And I think that early on in Parley's life began to help shape a more romantic, a more almost transcendental view of his life and the religion that he would eventually embrace. And we'll come back to that. He, of course, eventually, while on that, began to have thoughts of romance. And he had courted a woman back in Ohio that he then journeyed back to see if she was still available.
Parley described going to the doorstep of Thankful Halsey for the first time in 3 years. He spoke of his affections for her, and then she said this to him. "I have loved you during 3 years' absence," said she, "and I never can be happy without you." They were married September the 9th, 1827.
She was not able to have children. The story is that, and Parley tells this in his autobiography, that they struggled with that. They wanted children, but they were just unable to have any. But that after they joined the church, Heber C. Kimball came to Parley, and in the process of encouraging Parley to undertake a mission into Canada, promised him that if he'd be faithful, that in fact his wife would conceive and she would have children, and made some other promises to him. And so he did undertake that mission, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But he, Thankful did conceive, but of course the price for that for them was that she died shortly after the child was born. And Parley had to put into the ground his beloved first wife. I'm not sure he ever got over that, really.
A major feature of Parley's conversion to the gospel, well, it was the Book of Mormon. The Book of Books, he called it.
He would try to live by the Spirit even before he heard of Mormonism. And he and his wife were on a boat on the Erie Canal and felt the Spirit to get off at one location and sent his wife on and wandered into the city, found somebody who happened to have a copy of the Book of Mormon and read it. And he's very descriptive in his autobiography that he couldn't eat or sleep. This book just pulled him in. And eventually, of course, he had to meet the man who was responsible for this book. And so he journeyed, met Joseph Smith, and not long after was sent on the first of what would become a lifetime of missions for the church.
That first mission was into the wilderness among the Lamanites.
From New York, he traveled west, but he, having remembered his former religious associates in Ohio convinced the four Lamanite missionaries, including Oliver Cowdery, to kind of make a detour and go up to the Mentor area of northeastern Ohio, I guess. And while there, introduced Sidney Rigdon to the Book of Mormon and the claims of Mormonism, and in a very short time gathered that group at the Morley Farm just outside of Kirtland, where they partly taught them, and almost overnight, there's about 130 people that joined the church. In fact, overnight, almost literally, there are more members of the church in Ohio than there are in New York. And so Parley leaves them, and they continue on their mission down to Missouri, becoming some of the first, missionaries in what would become the Jackson County area.
Now, both Pratt brothers were writers. Their written works demonstrating their different perspectives on the gospel.
I mean, there's two major strains of thought in kind of early 19th century America. One is this strong, sort of enlightened, scientific worldview that comes out of the 17th and 18th century that helped create the natural sciences and observation and the inductive method to discover truth. The other is kind of a reaction to that classical enlightened tradition, and that tradition is that there's truth that can't be found directly through scientific observation. It comes through intuition. It comes through piety, through feeling, not just the mind. Mm-hmm. And it often finds expression, of course, in poetry. And so what you'll find, I think, as we talk about Parley's writings in early Mormonism, is he was influenced in part by that tradition, and much of his understanding of Mormonism and his contributions to Mormonism can in large measure be understood as a part of that romantic tradition of early America. And it is a tradition that emphasizes experience over just information. It's expressed in poetry and in essays. Parley Pratt published the first collection of poems in the church, the Millennium, he called it, which contained some of the earliest hymns. Some of them would be put into Emma Smith's hymn book in 1835, 36 when it actually came out. And later he would expand it in 1840 into a much expanded version with some essays. So now Parley's brother, Parley, of course, helped convert his brother Orson. Orson was baptized on his 19th birthday in September of 1830. And for both of them, it was a lifetime of church service. That doesn't mean that they didn't have personality conflicts and that. But Orson very early is studying mathematics. He's studying science. He's mostly self-taught. But he turns, rather than to the world of poetry and the romantic tradition, Orson tends to turn to the world of science and more the inductive methods for arriving at truth. So very early, Orson's concerned with the study of the more physical sciences. You see that demonstrated in much of Orson's later published tracts, where he is defining, arguing very... I mean, he presents Mormon doctrines as if he's kind of solving a mathematical equation. He grabs his scriptural evidence, he quotes them, he very carefully considers what the scriptural texts mean, and then he draws conclusions. And in a world of early Mormonism, where the missionary message is best reduced to a kind of a common, simple message, Orson Pratt's tracts were very, very useful for missionaries going out into the field, for whether they debated, whether they were giving talks, whether they were just giving what we'd call discussions. Having these texts at their hands and arguments in favor of the Mormon message were very, very valuable. Now, it wasn't that Parley was incapable of doing that, but I think it just represents in early Mormonism two fairly distinctive ways of approaching it. And I think Mormonism historically has encouraged both, that we have to be students, but that's not enough. You have to get on your knees and get confirmation from a heavenly source that there's more to reality than just what we can see with our eyes and ears and what we can measure. And that humble dimension, I think, is an important thing.
So these two brothers represented the differences in approach. Some of their writings are popular even today. Imagine a book having gone through 58 printings.
one of the things that you see when you study the two writings. Parley will print about 40 works. Orson Pratt will print almost the same. I think there's 39 works that he printed. So they're very productive. These are the two brothers, bar none, were the most published authors in 19th century Mormonism. Parley's first big book was published in 1837, called The Voice of Warning. It was easily the most popular book in 19th century Mormonism. I think it's gone through something like 58 printings in the history of the church. And it's still in print today. It's a very, very popular book. And it breaks down into very neat chapters the basic doctrines of the church, from whether it's the coming forth of the Book of Mormon to belief in Revelation to the kingdom of God. And at the end has this nice little section on comparing Mormonism with other religions, which was very useful in a missionary context as well.
Now, you'll remember that both of these brothers, Parley and Orson, as members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, were part of that mission of the 12 to England in 1839 and 40.
Now, once they get to the British Isles, of course, Parley is well on his way to publishing. Orson's just getting started. Parley will ask for and be given the right by conference vote to establish the church periodical in England, the Millennial Star. It will be issued beginning in May of 1840 and will exist clear down to 1970. It was the longest printed church periodical. Both brothers would publish really to their dying day. Parley would prepare in the 1850s his autobiography, which is one of the classics of Mormon literature and a book that I think would be valuable for anyone wanting to serve a mission ought to read. The spirit, the strength, the testimony that comes across his autobiography, which wasn't published until after his death. It isn't published till 1874. But it's a magnificent record of this man's life. Some would say his most comprehensive book was published in 1855, Key to the Science of Theology. And there Parley really pulls together a lot of threads that he had woven in some of these early essays and pamphlets, in which he then backs off and talks about the Godhead and the spirit world. And I mean, it remains, I think, one of the great works in Mormon thought. Again, pretty much unknown today.
And Orson's contributions? Well, they were no less meaningful.
Orson's works after the 1850s tended to be more and more scientific and more scriptural. Orson would do a lot of work on astronomy, would do a lot of work on mathematics. That's one of the threads that runs through his life, this desire to get precise. He did, his astronomy lectures were published in the 1870s. By then, he's well-respected as a scientist. He's a major factor in the popularization of science among young Mormons, some of whom will go on later to establish careers in science. One of his great contributions, I think, was before Brigham's death, but after Brigham's death, he was given responsibility to prepare new editions of the LDS Standard Works. And he's a man who is concerned with exactness, and so again, he brings that skill to prepare the Pearl Great Price had been printed in 1851, but they wanted to do a new edition, because by the first edition of the Pearl Great Price had a lot of material in it that we don't have in our current edition. And they did that because it was hard to get copies of the Doctrine and Covenants then, so there were sections of the Doctrine and Covenants and some Mormon hymns, and Orson made the decision to take that stuff out and essentially make it the way we know it today, and that was printed in 1871 and then was canonized in October of 1880 at a general conference. Orson had lived with Joseph Smith in Kirtland, had made copies, he tells us, in several places that he'd made, was allowed to see the original manuscripts when he lived with Joseph and acted as a scribe for a short time. He made copies that he could keep and study. And he also said that Joseph told him that not all the revelations were originally meant to be printed in the Doctrine and Covenants, that some would, in fact, appear in his history. And that's what happened. There were a number of revelations, like one could think of what we know as Section 110 of the Doctrine and Covenants, the great visions of the Savior accepting the temple and Moses and Elijah and so forth. That was never printed in the Doctrine and Covenants. It was printed in the Joseph Smith's history that was published in the Deseret News in November of 1852. Mm-hmm. But Orson added it along with something like 27 other sections to the Doctrine and Covenants in 1876 edition. And he did one other thing. He divided these up to, he versified the revelations.
In early Utah, when the church decided to make public the Latter-day Saint practice of plural marriage, it was Orson Pratt who was asked to take the stand and teach the doctrine publicly. That was August of 1852.
It is one of the classic discourses, if anybody wants to study what the Mormons said in their defense. His discourse on August 29, 1852 is the classic. And Brigham knew that once the doctrine was publicly announced, that they better not let their enemies have the floor. So a number of Mormons are called to go on special publishing missions. And Orson himself, the great defender of it now, would go to Washington, D.C., where he would print the Seer in 1854 and 55. Each month of the 12 months of that publication, he has an installment on what he calls celestial marriage. And it remains to this day probably the most sophisticated, extended understanding from a faithful Mormon point of view of what plural marriage was and wasn't. Now, Parley, of course, would actually write the first defense of plural marriage, surprisingly.
Both brothers were diligent and effective missionaries. Their sacrifices in that work, too numerous to note.
In 1851, he would go to Valparaiso, Chile, to open up the missions there. I think Parley hoped that the missionary work in South America would be as successful as it had been in the British Isles that he had participated in the 1840s. That proved not to be the case. The Catholic Church was very strong. He couldn't even get his tracts printed in Chile. But Orson, of course, was constantly on missions. I mean, he served missions. I think he crossed the Atlantic something like 16 or 18 times. I don't remember the number.
Parley Parker Pratt was murdered in Arkansas in 1857. He died at the hands of an abusive former husband of one of his plural wives, his productive life tragically cut short.
Orson, of course, would live almost 25 more years. And again, he's more known in Mormonism because of his more publications, larger editions, and he lived longer. He became church historian. He would later go back with Joseph F. Smith and interview witnesses of the Book of Mormon, would visit the Hill Cumorah, would go visit a lot of the sites that he'd written about and testified about. But then he got diabetes at the end of the 1880s and died essentially of complications of diabetes I can't remember the date, but it's 1881 when he finally passed away. And at his funeral, Wilford Woodruff said that no man has done more to defend the doctrines and travel. And so they paid very, very high tribute to Orson. And of course, they did with Parley, too.
Just before he died, President Brigham Young changed the rule of seniority in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles.
Before, seniority in the Quorum of the 12 was determined by date of birth. What Brigham did in 1876 was to change it by date of ordination. And that's how it's done today, date of ordination to the apostleship. Well, if he hadn't have done that, Orson Hyde and then Orson Pratt would have been the next presidents of the church. But by changing it to date of ordination, and both of them had been in trouble and been out of the church for a short time, that put their seniority back. Or there's no evidence Orson ever screamed about it. He was probably glad not to have that burden, I suppose, because he had lots of other things he'd been assigned to do. John Taylor and he seems to have gotten along very, very well. He gave Orson lots of assignments with the scriptures and other things. One of the accounts in Brigham Young's office journal is one of the men there keeping Brigham's records was saying some things about Orson that he didn't like. And Brigham says, wait a minute. He says, if Orson Pratt were cut into one-inch squares, every inch would cry out, Mormonism is true. So I don't think Brigham ever doubted the core testimony and faith of Orson Pratt.
Now, as a benediction of sorts to the lives of these two noble brothers, Doctrine and Covenants, Section 76, states the following. I, the Lord, am merciful and gracious unto those who fear me, and delight to honor those who serve me in righteousness and truth unto the end. And so they did.
Now, when you look back on their lives, they're just two old workhorses. I mean, they wore their lives out in various ways, defending the church, leading it. I mean, they were involved. We haven't talked about the immigration program and their great role in preparing ships to bring immigrants to Zion. They just are the Deseret Alphabet. We haven't talked about that, but there's just a lot of things that one could talk about, but at the core was this desire to explain and defend and bear strong testimony as apostles to what they'd been called to do.
Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, William Clayton and the Knight family, stalwarts to the very end. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel, a production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.